We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
You rise up in the morning beneath the stars so bright. Pull your hat down, make sure your cinch is tight. Horse is kind of snuffy, cold chill up your spine. You'll get your ass moving, sun will burn in daylight.
Howdy there, I'm Matt McKinley, and we're burning daylight.
In the saddle till the job's done right.
Welcome to Burning Daylight, the only podcast for the working cowboy.
Well, welcome back, Daylight Burners. As I'm recording it, it's a Sunday night, December 3rd, but this is the friggin' Farm and Ranch Report for December 4th, Monday, December 4th, 2023. We'll go ahead. I hope you guys had a good weekend and everything treated you well. I was pretty all right over here. Cooling off, but can't complain too much on the weather. Getting ready for Christmas. And, yeah, it's that time of year. So, anyway, we'll just jump right into it. We'll start off with a market report. This is from National Beef Wire. As of Friday p.m., live cattle closed out... finished out down 270 at 169.125. Feeder cattle down 525, down 552.5 at 214.425. Hogs down 1.375 at 70.10. Corns up 2 at 484.75. Soybeans up are down 16. Ooh, they're down quite a way. 16.75 at 13.455. Wheat's up 4.75 at 602.75. Cotton's down 64 at 79.42. The Dow closed up 294.61. NASDAQ up 78.81, S&P up 26.83, and the note says finish higher on dovish Fed outlook. So the Fed looks like maybe they're not going to raise interest rates the next go-round. I wouldn't count on that. Inflation's still way up regardless of what the administration is trying to spin it as. Shit's still expensive, so the interest rates will probably go up again, whether it's this time or not, I don't know. But it's like I said, if you look back to the 80s when they had to counter the stagflation of the 70s and the oil crisis and all that horseshit, you were looking at like 15-20% interest rates on a mortgage. So we're a long ways from that, and I wouldn't be surprised to see us hit up in that range again. So keep an eye on that. Crude oil was down 158 at 74.38. Heating oil was down. Natural gas was down. Choice beef was down 156 at 297.46. Select was up 74 at 265.49 with the choice select spread at 31.97. Uh, looked like a winter storm through the weekend in the northwest. We didn't see much. Had some wind. Had kind of almost moisture, but not much. Looked like the southeast got some rain, so hopefully that helped y'all out quite a bit. I know that's been the worst part of the drought. I'm still working on getting some guys together, and it might have to wait till after the first of the year with Christmas coming up and all that. But I would like to have kind of a round table with some southeastern guys and figure out how they handle drought down there and what drought looks like for them as opposed to what I picture in my head anyway. So, because it's just a different world down there. live cattle trade at 174 to 175. Thus far for Friday, the Texas Panhandle negotiated cash trade has been at a standstill. Most recent live FOB purchases were Monday at 175. In Kansas, cash trade has been mostly inactive on light demand. Most recent market was Tuesday with live FOB purchases at 174. In Nebraska, cash trade has been slow on light demand. Most recent market was Thursday with live purchases from 174 to 175 and dress delivered purchases at 275. Western Corn Belt negotiated cash trade has been slow on light demand. Most recent live FOB purchases were Thursday from 174 to 175 and dress deliveries at 275. So not much going on there. Cattle on feed, inventory was up 2%. Placements were up 4% above 2022. Placements were at 2.11 million head. So roughly half the inventory in October was because of placements. So a lot of turnover that time of year. It seems, I guess, beef exports, net sales of 6,300 metric tons for 2023 were down 37% from previous week and 49% from prior four-week average. Huh. I wonder what caused that. Increases primarily for South Korea, decreases, for South Korea, Japan, Canada, China, and Mexico were offset by reductions for Hong Kong. So for whatever reason, exports were down quite a bit, it seemed like. 37%, that's a lot. I don't know enough about the export market to comment too much on that. Beef production was up 18% from last week. And livestock comments from Dr. Andrew Griffith. Cattle are worth absolutely nothing. They cannot even be given away. Feedlots may as well give them their pink slip and send them to the packing house to get them off the payroll. I apologize for digressing, but it feels as if finished cattle prices are pointing towards the end of time, despite finished cattle prices failing to push higher and even hold par leading up to the end of the year. Holidays prices are not terrible. The only reason they seem terrible is because of how much cattle feeders paid for the cattle when they were placed on feed. It's exactly the reason cattle feeders are bidding less on feeder cattle today. Strong profits will come back around sooner than later. The key is not losing the farm on those being marketed today. So, tough market for sure. That's kind of about it. Next up from the Western Ag Reporter, I saw a couple different sites, but I subscribe to Western Ag Reporter, so I'll read from here, but Colorado Wolf Rule provides lethal take options. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finalized a ruling that classifies the gray wolf as an experimental population under Section 10J of the Endangered Species Act. according to the USFWS, the 10J ruling will provide management flexibility in support of the state of Colorado's voter-mandated gray wolf reintroduction program. The ruling will go into effect December 8th, 2023, and wolf reintroduction is set to begin on December 31st, 2023. Andy Spann, a cow-calf producer in Gunnison, Colorado, is thankful for the 10J ruling and believes it is a very, very important part for reducing conflict with ag producers. It's going to be, speaking on the wolf reintroduction, it's going to be very impactful, not just for our operation, but for everybody's operation. In October, Colorado Parks and Wildlife announced that Oregon Fish Department of Fish and Wildlife will be a source for up to 10 wolves for the Colorado gray wolf reintroduction efforts. The Colorado Wolf Restoration Plan Final, outlined the ideal release locations, which are constrained by several factors. Releases must be a minimum of 60 miles from Colorado's borders with Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, as well as similar buffer as requested by the tribes of the sovereign lands in southwest Colorado. Based on these factors, along with ideal habitat for wolves, the two proposed release sites are first along the I-70 corridor between Glenwood Springs and Vail, and extends down to the Roaring Fork Valley. The second southern area is along the Highway 50 corridor between Monarch Pass, east of Gunnison, and Montrose. The second release site would put wolves essentially in Spann's backyard. Spann described the Gunnison Basin as a big bowl. In the winter, he explained a large number of deer, elk, and other wildlife funnel down and move into the bottom of the basin. Spann expressed his primary concern is having his and other people's calving operations within a quarter mile of where the elk winter, which are in theory the wolves' main source of food. Our operation already has somebody out calving 24 hours a day. We don't really have a problem with predators, but that might change. So he goes on to talk a little bit more about that. Yeah, it's a big deal. Those wolves can really wreak havoc, and we've seen that up in Montana and Idaho. And there's a reason the old timers killed them out. You know, it was they had a legit reason for it. So the lethal take options, Greg Peterson, a cow-calf producer east of Gunnison, is also thankful for the 10J ruling, but stressed it is not just as simple as having lethal take options. The lethal take options are there. They are a possibility, but you really need to read how those processes will take place. In other words, how they'll be executed to have lethal take, and then the potential repercussions if you do that, Peterson cautioned. Peterson explained it's not simple as being able to exercise lethal take first time you see a wolf going after your livestock. According to the plan, lethal management should not generally be a first line of defense. Even if wolves are seen biting or harassing livestock, the plan suggests non-lethal methods of hazing be used first. So it's like the rules of engagement for the later stages of Iraq and Afghanistan, where like they had to be shooting at you while also cursing out your mother in order for our troops to be able to return fire or something like that. In order for a producer to have the ability for lethal take of wolves that are harassing or killing livestock, they must first receive a permit from Parks and Wildlife, and non-lethal conflict mitigation measures will be considered prior to issuance of any lethal take permit. If a wolf is killed by a producer with a permit, it must be reported to CPW within 24 hours, and then a preponderance of evidence, including dead or injured livestock or working dogs or other physical evidence, should be present, which would lead a reasonable person to believe that a depredating wolf or wolves were involved, or that a wolf attack on livestock or dogs was occurring or imminent. It's not as simple as that you just have the ability to kill them now. Yeah, so it's a step in the right direction. They're at least recognizing that there's a legit producer concern there. Like I said, it's better than nothing. So kind of along the same, this is also from Western Ag Journal. But along the same lines, there's a 10-year study on the effect of cattle grazing and the sage grouse, conducted by the University of Idaho. So we'll read from this, from the Western Ag Journal, or Western Ag Reporter, sorry. In October 2023, researchers at the University of Idaho released the preliminary findings from a revolutionary 10-year study, which made some positive connections between moderate livestock grazing and the success of greater sage grouse nests. The study, led by Courtney Conway, PhD, is the largest of its kind in terms of length, sample size, and acres studied. It found that spring cattle grazing at moderate intensities has no effect on and might actually lead to increases in greater sage grouse populations. Springtime is generally the most crucial period for sage grouse survival, the study's overview explains, because that is when sage grouse hens nest and raise broods. The research plan was designed to produce scientifically defensible information that could be used to inform grazing management decisions and promote healthy sage grouse populations. Previous studies of this nature have merely been conducted at small plot level. Conway's study, on the other hand, spanned 19 BLM pastures, which totaled more than 1,000 acres, and was made possible with the cooperation of local ranches, including Idaho's J.R. Simplot Company. The study sites were selected needed to have 15% or more sagebrush cover and an herbaceous understory, or the lowest level of plants, of mostly native grasses and forbs, at least one sage grouse lek of 25 males or more, less than 38 centimeters of annual precipitation, and at least 5,700 acres of land largely free of infrastructure development. So it seems like it was a pretty intensive study. Additionally, cooperating land permittees needed to have established spring turnout dates for their cattle. During the first 2 years of the study, regular grazing practices were maintained in the test pastures in order for baseline data to be collected. Then in subsequent years, and the subsequent 4 years, test grazing regimens were implemented. For instance, one pasture could have spring grazing on odd years, and another would have spring grazing on even years. A different pasture would have no grazing whatsoever. And finally, the last test have spring and fall grazing every year. Spring was defined as March 1 through June 15, and fall grazing fell between September 1st and December 15th. Data was collected in the form of vegetation measurement, percent biomass at nests or random plots, and invertebrate sampling, among other data points. Additionally, more than 150 female sage grouses were captured and marked annually. Researchers monitored and documented the movement of hens within the periphery of the study locations and kept tabs on successful versus failed hatchings. We used telemetry to locate radio-collared sage grouse hens every 2 to 3 days unless logistically feasible. If a hen was not located in the nest, the location would be inspected to determine the fate of the chicks based on the condition or the presence of eggshells. At the end of the 2022 season, the researchers concluded that it was a very successful field season. In 2022, the project tracked more nests than any other year, despite only conducting field work at 4 study sites, the 2022 annual report shows. Sorry, my eyes are drying out. I'm going to spray some drops in here so I can read this. Read these stories for you better. I can read, I promise, fellas. And ladies, too. I'm sure there's like three of you out there. While overall nesting success was below average in 22, potentially due to a cool, wet spring, a high occurrence of re-nesting helped to increase the number of broods. In the past, with smaller studies, conclusions have been drawn that grazing and grass height has an effect on greater sage-grouse nesting success. However, Conway's larger-scale study does not agree with the interpretation of the results at a plot level. He hypothesizes that sage-grouse in smaller-scale studies may rely on taller grass to better hide from predators, but at a pasture scale, cows tend to graze in areas with fewer shrubs. Therefore, we may not see a strong link between grazing and sage-grouse nesting success at large scales. Another potential explanation is that some nest predators may be avoiding pastures where cattle are present. Researchers have also hypothesized that nest success near grazing cattle could relate to the greater abundance of a variety of arthropods due to manure. More than 90% of the diet of 1 to 4 week old chicks is comprised of arthropods, University of Idaho release explained. I think this is a significant outcome for the ranching community, which has wondered all along what they would do if scientists learned that spring grazing was bad for grouse. Karen Launchbach, the co-lead investigator of the study, said in the release, had we found that spring grazing had a negative effect on grouse populations, it could have resulted in the loss of grazing allotments on federal land, something cattle ranchers, especially smaller operations, need for their businesses to survive. And they went on and talked about the participation of ranchers in the study. So there was the breadth of Conway's study would not have been achieved without the participation of ranchers. Through the dedication of pastures for the study and a study advisory group, Idaho cattlemen have been integral to helping the study reach its current scope. Wendy Pratt, a member of Pratt Family Beef, which has been operating in Blackfoot, Idaho since her husband's ancestors homesteaded in 1904, was part of the advisory committee for Conway's study. Pratt had also been involved in the local sage-grouse working group because she and many other longtime producers have seen the plummeting numbers of the birds. While the Pratts weren't able to dedicate pastures to the study without a spring grazing system and because of a sheer lack of birds on their range, old timers say they used to be plentiful. However, she emphasized the importance that the scientists include ranchers at the design phase of the research projects. This inspires research that is useful and can be applied to find solutions real time. Pratt reiterated the study has yet to be peer-reviewed and it only studied moderate grazing. It would be incorrect to say that grazing does not affect sage-grouse. It depends on the type of grazing, timing, and intensity, for example. Nest success and insect abundance are only the first data set to be examined. There is much more to come as scientists wade through mountains of data that has been collected over the 10 years of the study, Pratt stated. What Conway is sure of at this point, however, is that this unprecedented study is expected to influence policy for the next 50 years in Idaho and throughout the West. So, this seems like it's a really, really good big win for ranchers on BLM ground, particularly those in the sage grouse habitat area. So, Oregon, I think there's some here in Nevada, and I'm sure. And then Idaho as well. I don't know about Utah, and I don't know, but either way, this seems. I hope the peer review goes well, and it seems like it's a good study. So I hope it gets all the accolades it deserves, and maybe you can start to see more of a common sense based partnership with the BLM and the ranchers. Like, I don't know if it ever has existed like that. I know there's there's isolated accounts of really good working relationships with the BLM, and maybe they're not so isolated, but I know there's also a lot of button heads too. So maybe this will help kind of foster a better partnership moving forward. I mean, ideally, you'd like to. I would like the BLM to not exist, and that all to be figured out by private property, but that's not the world we live in, and so this seems like at least it's a step in the right direction towards a better working relationship with the BLM and these ranchers. So we'll see. Time will tell how the peer review holds up and how policy gets made. But it seems if it is as good as it seems, like it might be a model of how to go about doing some of these studies in the future. And that's kind of one of the big issues that us folks out here in flyover country that get ignored is just like, hey, at least listen to us before you, when you're going to go change all this shit, like listen to the people that it affects and what these policies would, how they would affect them. 'Cause a lot of the people, most of the people, if not all of the people setting the policy for this, like they don't actually work in these sectors. They're just lawyers and lobbyists. So, this seems like, hopefully it's a good study. Like I said, hopefully it comes through and the people that review it come away thinking the same thing and it starts the ball moving towards a better relationship with the BLM. But time will tell and we'll see. This one I found pretty interesting. So this is from the Investing News Network. This was about a month ago, but Nutrien study finds and quantifies perception gap between farmers and the gentle public. All right, so Nutrien LTD today released Bridging the Agricultural Perception Divide, a study by Nutrien. The research details and quantifies the perception gaps between farmers and consumers in North America on issues such as sustainability, technology, and land usage. It also indicates there is some common ground and opportunities for bridge building. Farmers and consumers agree, this is a quote from the study, farmers and consumers agree agriculture has the greatest opportunity to influence a sustainable future, more so than any other industry. This alignment is incredibly promising and provides the foundation for us to build common understanding, said Ken Seitz, president and CEO of Nutrien. The world is asking a lot of our farmers, and it is incumbent on all of us to support them in safely and sustainably feeding the future. Study, which was conducted among 604 crop farmers and 3,003 consumers in the U.S. and Canada, evaluated 22 statements, uncovering four areas where perceptions varied the most. I like how it's just U.S. and Canada, even though they say it's in North America. They just leave out Mexico. They're just like, let's face it, these guys don't give a shit about sustainability. They're just gonna, we're gonna use them as a, you know, that's where we kick all the stuff that we don't want to do. We're not ready to ship over to China yet, but we don't want to do it here necessarily. We'll send that down to Mexico. It seems like a good plan. Evaluated 22 statements, uncovering four key areas where perceptions varied the most. That being environmental stewardship, industry advancement, social responsibility, and societal support for farmers. So environmental stewardship, they say sustainable care of agricultural land. Industry advancement includes innovation and adoption of modern farming techniques to support a growing population and evolving dietary needs. So they're teaching you how to grow them bugs. Social responsibility, meaning fair and transparent food sources and pricing. Societal support for farmers, including farming income, government support, and assistance with new farming practices. The findings revealed the largest perception gaps between farmers and consumers are around topics related to environmental stewardship and industry advancement. For example, farmers were significantly more likely to agree with the statements related to the responsible use of crop inputs, chemical use and environmental progress, farming careers, and soil quality. However, topics related to societal support for farmers reveals much closer agreement. The study also finds that younger consumers have the lowest interest and trust in agriculture. So that's a big problem. So they're saying farmers were significantly more likely to agree with statements related to their responsible use of crop inputs, chemical use, environmental progress, farming careers, and soil quality, but the consumers were not. So when farmers were asked about the top issues affecting the agriculture industry today, their responses included the rising cost of growing food, followed by a desire for consumers to have more knowledge about the industry, and concerns around misinformation about where food comes from and how it's produced. However, 60% of consumers want to learn more about agriculture, including 2/3 of Canadians and more than half of U.S. respondents. Addressing the trust gap in agriculture can not only unify farmers and consumers, but also ignite the interest and passion of younger generations who seek purpose-driven roles, said Jeff Tarsi, Executive Vice President and President of Global Retail for Nutrien. These emerging voices prioritize sustainability, innovation, and global impact, and there's no mission more critical than that of modern agriculture. As we work to rectify misconceptions and forge a shared vision, we recognize that farmers are unwavering in their dedication to the land, blah, 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 blah. All right, so they agreed that there needs to be more societal support for farmers. Farmers and consumers agreed on that. They didn't agree so much on the environmental stewardship and the industry advancement. And a lot of that comes down to organic, regenerative, and I bet you a lot of it has to do with Roundup and glyphosate from the consumer end of things, which one of these days the farmers will come around to the realization that, yes, that shit does indeed cause cancer, and people that made it knew about it for quite some time. And it's, yeah, all around just, it's a wonderful weed killer. Not good for human consumption, turns out. But anyway, that's just my understanding of it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. So don't sue me over it. But I generally tend to believe that shit's pretty bad for you. And I think, it's Monsanto that owns it. I'm pretty sure they knew. Take a look into Monsanto's past, and you'll find all sorts of cool stuff. Now, moving on, we've got a rash of bannings of lab-grown meat, fake meat, vegetarian alternative to meat, or meat replacement, whatever, Beyond Burger, all that stuff. So Italy has bans lab-grown meat and tofu steak in a bid to protect prosciutto and the people who make it. Prosciutto is delicious. So I'm not typically big on government banning stuff at all, but if it means more prosciutto, I'm okay with it. Italy's government has moved to ban the production of lab-grown meat, a landmark move to the country's right-wing government says it has taken to protect Italian culture and its agricultural sector. The country becomes the first in Europe to ban the cultivation of artificial meat, with the bill signed into law Thursday after winning an overwhelming majority in Italy's Senate. Factories found to be producing lab-grown meat faces fines of up to 150,000 euros under the new guidelines, which is about $163,000. Cauliflower steaks are also off the menu as the country moved to ban the use of meat-related words to market vegetarian products. Words like tofu steak or veg prosciutto reveal an inappropriate phenomenon of using labels traditionally associated with meat to sell products with vegetable protein. The Financial Times reported the bill as reading. We are the first nation to ban it, to the chagrin of multinational companies that hope to make monstrous profits, jeopardizing the jobs and health of citizens. Francesco Lolo Brigida, the Minister for Food Sovereignty and Agriculture, said on in a post on Facebook. Francesco Lolo Brigida. Lolo Brigida. A bibbidi bobbidi. You can't have the fake meat. The real meatball. No, none of the fake shit. Alright, so. Look at you go, Italy. Look at you go. Italy's ban to move the products has been praised by Italian agriculture groups, keen to keep the country's 9.3 billion euro meat processing industry. Cordoretti, Italy's biggest farmers association, warned that the allowance of lab-cultured meat would herald the rise of multinational companies at the expense of local Italian producers. He's probably not wrong. We are proud to be the first country that, despite being in favor of research, preemptively blocks the sale of lab-produced food. The effects, which are currently unknown on the health of consumer citizens, Tori Prandini, president of Coldiretti, said in a Facebook post. While there is obvious economic motivation behind Italy protecting its meat industry, it also reflects a bigger culture war being waged by Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and her right-wing Brothers of Italy party. Anyway, I guess there's some issues with the EU. Here we go. While Italy can stop companies from producing artificial meat domestically, it faces a tougher time regulating its sale in the country. Italy is part of the European Union's Single Market and Customs Union, ensuring the free movement of goods and services across Europe. So, yeah, I don't know how that's going to work out, but Florida thought it was a great idea, and they did the same thing, or they're looking to. Florida bill, this is from Fox Business, would ban lab-grown meat to protect cattle and farming industries. A Florida Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill that would criminalize the sale and distribution of lab-grown meat as part of an effort to preserve the state's cattle and farming industries. The proposal, known as House Bill 435, aims to make it unlawful for any person to manufacture, sell, hold, or offer for sale or distribute cultivated meat as defined as any meat of food product produced from cultured animal cells in the state of Florida. The bill seeks to establish criminal and licensing penalties, as well as provide that such products are subject to an immediately stopped sale order. The bill says anyone who violates the ban would be subject to a second-degree misdemeanor, while any establishment that distributes or sells cultivated meat is subject to disciplinary action, including suspension of the business's license. The legislation would authorize the State Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to adopt rules to implement the ban. State Representative Tyler Tyler, I like Cirrhosis better. I bet he's a boozer. Tyler Cirrhosis, who introduced the bill earlier this week, told Politico that he believes lab-grown meat is an affront to nature and creation and is part of the latest initiative in the ESG agenda, that's environmental social governance. GOP presidential candidate and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has taken a bold stance against ESG, arguing that the globalist ideology threatens economic freedom and other American values. I looked up this dude. Let me see if I can find him. Tyler Cirrhosis. Tyler Cirrhosis. He had a... Yeah, there we go. I found his website, and proven conservative leadership. He kind of looks like a younger Ted Cruz without the widow's peak. He's a father, husband, community leader, public servant dedicated to the principles of limited government, individual responsibility, and constitutional liberty. So limited that he wants to ban an entire product from being produced in his state. That's how limited he wants his government. Yeah, he's probably got a bunch. Wonder where his district is. Meet Tyler. Let's meet Tyler. He's a father, a husband, a community leader, public servant, dedicated to the principles of limited government, individual responsibility, and constitutional liberty. Cirroy is how you call his name. Cocoa Beach High School. That's where my sister-in-law and her husband lived there for a little while. Went to Florida State. Probably banged a lot of hoes there at Florida State. He worked for the Regional Aerospace Workforce Initiative, a partnership between the Florida High Tech Corridor Council and Brevard Workforce. So he's just been some sort of government worker. Currently, Tyler works to support our law enforcement, prosecutors, and victims of crime as executive director for the Office of State Attorney Phil Archer. So he's a lawyer, and he's worked as a government employee of some point. And I wonder if he thinks his job should exist. I bet he does, because limited government, you know, limited government. Anyways, I think, and this is me, my personal thoughts on this. I think this banning of meat's a bad idea, or of the lab-grown meat. I think it's a shit product. I have no doubt that the powers that be will eventually try to use this stuff as much as they can, and the big meat packers will, if they can figure out how to mass produce it cheaply, they'll be all in favor for it, because they won't have to worry. What was it? Oh, sorry, I was reading a comment there. Anyway, they won't have to eat it. They'll use it to serve to, like, prisoners, like in the prison system or something like that. Joe says I sound like I'm underwater. I will might have to fix that in post. Let me I'm gonna take a slight recess and we'll come back. All right, I think I'm back. I think hopefully that sounds better. If not, I will have to fix that in post and hopefully get this re-uploaded. But anyway, I think this is a bad idea because, like I said, I have no doubt that if this shit's if they're able to produce this stuff cheaply and efficiently, the Packers will love it because then they'll no longer have to deal with the goddamn ranchers that are always in their hair wanting more money for their cattle and shit. You know, they've got their little system set up with the dairymen that they can just crank out those crossbred calves. That's a steady supply. And now they just put a bunch of goo just on a package and you vacuum seal that. And there is no rancher involved whatsoever. And the Packer man is happy because that's just one less step that he has to take. And it's not a good product, I'm sure. But I don't think banning it's I'm all for free enterprise. Let them make it, and if people want to buy it, I have at it. It's probably going to taste like shit. Probably not good for you. It's not good for the environment. Or at least it's not any worse or any better for the environment than just raising the damn cow is. And also, it's not natural. Like, it's not good for you. I don't see any way that it could be good for you. But let the market decide that. And I'm fine with the labeling stuff. Like, yeah, don't try to trick people. And also, like, don't use it as a cheapo deal just to feed it to a bunch of prisoners. You know, like, do that. If we don't know what the shit's going to do to people, like, you're no better than the Nazis. That's what they did. So, no, I think let the market figure it out. And and I think that the stuff should be tested to every level possible. But I guess they already cleared it for human consumption, so it's a matter of time. But also, you're gonna have a bunch of hipsters that are gonna be like having these lab meat speakeasies, you know, because it's illegal in Florida, so they're gonna set up like a underground restaurant that only serves lab meat, and then it'd be like the hot spot in Miami or some bullshit like that. Maybe it's not going to happen in Florida so much. That definitely, I could see that happening in California, but the thing is, they're not going to ban lab-grown meat in California. Come on. They're not going to do that. They'll ban natural meat in California before they ban the lab-grown shit. Maybe that's what they need to do in California, is ban real meat, and then it'll make it kitschy and cool again, and all the hipsters will have their little speakeasy so they can go get a steak, and maybe that'll like slowly fix California culture over time, just like the sheer injection of protein and animal product into their diet, just like causes a surge in testosterone, and all of a sudden they're not quite as bitchy. Maybe, probably not, but I don't know. It makes about as much sense as banning this stuff, and unless it's like been proven to be really dangerous, like it's gonna kill you, you know, real fast. I just don't see the benefit in banning it. I think it's a lazy move by the meat eaters, you know. Like, no, let's make a better argument. Like, hey, my shit's real. It's got one ingredient, and that's meat. You know, it's got protein and fat, and a bunch of amino acids and minerals and stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And it's not made in the lab. Like, it's pretty easy sell, really. No need to ban it, I don't think. All right, so moving on. We got the U.S. eludes a trade dispute over Canada's dairy market. This is from Agricultural Dive. Canada's method of allocating lower tariff rates to dairy importers does not limit access to the market. A dispute panel ruled on Friday, rejecting arguments from the U.S. that the country's majors breached trade commitments.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Alright. I got a... I'm not really for sure on how all this tariff stuff goes, but essentially it's a protection type deal that Canada has, and apparently it goes against the spirit of the USMCA Act. I don't know. It's all kind of gobbledygook to me, but either way, they ruled in favor of Canada, and I don't know what happens after that. So Canada just says, hey, piss off, guys. But also on this another note, Nestle and Kraft get a big win against egg producer in a price-fixing case. So Illinois federal jury found Cal, Maine, and other producers liable for limiting supply between 2004 and 2008 in an effort to drive up costs. A unanimous jury ruled that multiple major egg producers conspired to fix the price of the commodity between 2004 and 2008. The decision last week delivered a major victory to food giants such as Kraft Heinz and Nestle. So it wasn't anybody that anybody that was really wronged. It was just a bunch of giant corporations that got money. So it's probably bigger corporations beating up on these chicken producers, which are also giant corporations. But the initial lawsuit filed in the Northern District of Illinois in 2011, numerous food giants, including Nestle, Kraft, General Mills, and Kellogg, alleged egg producers, Cal Maine Foods, and Roseacre Farms, along with trade groups, the United Egg Producers, and U.S. Egg Marketers, conspired to artificially limit the supply of hens and kill them earlier than normal between 1998 and 2008. The major food manufacturers who purchased eggs from the producers alleged that this scheme caused prices of the eggs to increase, impacting their bottom line. Jurors declared the scheme took place for 4 years, ending in 2008. For the first time, the defendants have been held liable for their antitrust violations, said attorney Brandon Fox, who represented the food companies in the case. Cal Maine Foods, the largest egg producer in the U.S., said in a statement that it took action 20 years ago to improve the welfare of hens, and that it did not intend to limit supply and impact of the price and impact the price of eggs. The company claimed it was successful in proving that the time frame of the conspiracy did not run for 10 years like the initial lawsuit claimed. Cal Maine Foods will vigorously contest plaintiff's presentation of purported damages and will continue to assess the decision and options for appeal. So the total damages owed by producers to the victorious food companies will be decided by Wednesday, November 29th. So I don't know what they came up with, but I don't know enough about that case to really dive into it too much further, but there was a few other stories that I had. Dan One, Horizon Organic, suspends use of milk from Texas Farm at the center of a PETA report. I don't know what happened at this one, but I'm sure it was one of those PETA hit videos, and whether or not they do anything with that or not. Also in the news, there's this COP28 thing that I'm not sure when it if it's happened or is going to happen, but they're like agriculture is at the heart of it. And so this piece was like, it's called Devising a Just Transition for Sustainable Livestock Agriculture. So at least they're talking about like, hey, don't get rid of, you know, livestock agriculture and just go straight to bugs. At least give us like a grandfather period. But it's pretty tough going. They're saying farm income is to fall 17% from last year. With commodity prices declining and expenses rising, it's from Agriculture Dive. USDA expects the agriculture sector to see a significant profit declines in 2023. Farm income is expected to fall roughly 17% in 2023 as lower commodity prices and declining government payments weigh on the agriculture sector. Net farm income, a broad measure of profitability, is forecast to hit $151.1 billion. USDA's Economic Research Service said Thursday that's down from a record high of $182.8 billion last year. So, I mean, it's down 17%, but it's coming off of a record high. So, despite the drop, forecasted net farm income for 2023 is still 15% higher than the average of the last two decades. So 15% higher. So you're beating inflation, I guess, a little bit, but profits from 2021 to 2023 are the highest in the last 50 years, but also the highest inflation that we've had also. It's probably going to get worse. I mean, I don't know what happens to the family farm. Like, if they all just get bought up into these big conglomerates or what, but it's harder and harder to make a living at it, and I don't know where it goes. But there, with all this technology stuff, so there's an article here about how they're using a supercomputer down at the University of Florida and AI to determine how to breed plants specifically for taste and whatnot. So they're trying to like breed the, they're trying to like capture the modern American like food psyche and determine what flavors are going to be the most desirable and make like these hybrid, you know, super delicious plants, I guess. That I don't know. It's all kind of crazy, and I don't know where agriculture goes here in the coming years. But it's a wild one. And so there was another article here from Western Ag Reporter, and it was like Senator John Thune was speaking in the Ag Committee hearing on the innovation in American agriculture, leveraging technology and artificial intelligence. Throughout the hearing, testimonies from technology, manufacturing, and agriculture professionals were provided to demonstrate how precision agriculture can be used to increase yield, quality, and efficiency of crops and accurately monitor drought and track intake and other data points in livestock. Panelists also provided recommendations for overcoming potential obstacles and producer concerns with technology and artificial intelligence. One of that's being data sharing. We've come to find out over the past several years that your data is worth a lot. And then there was one here, like Del Monte is using regenerative agriculture down in, I believe it was, so we got Argentina, or Costa Rica, for pineapples, and they're doing it in Costa Rica on their own dime, because it's not subsidized in the U.S., so, but apparently it's helping their yields, and also the environment, and whatever, blah, blah, blah. It seems like there maybe is something to that regenerative farming stuff. If a company like Del Monte's putting their own money into it. So, and then this one, they're like, I think it was, there was a red dye that got, I don't know if it found that it causes cancer or something, if it got banned or whatever, but it was a common red food coloring agent that, but they're finding that there's a left, like an after, a byproduct from winemaking that can be used as a food coloring agent in like Jell-O and stuff that otherwise would have just got washed away. And I was like, huh, imagine that. They used to use all sorts of like beet juice and stuff to make paints and dyes and stuff. And yeah, why not? Why not from grapes? And it just, I don't know. Anytime you have a byproduct like that, like try to figure out a way to use it. And sometimes it doesn't always work. Like radioactive shit, you can't really do much with that. But there's, you know, when it's just this sludge that comes after the winemaking process, why not? Give it a shot. Try to find something to do with it. I guess kind of on some good string of maybe some good will be done with federal money. We'll end it on these stories, but the USDA invests nearly $28 million to support beginning farmers and ranchers. I don't know what all these programs entitle, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but I think they're finally starting to realize up in D.C. that your average rancher, farmer, they're getting older, and most of the kids ain't coming back, so like you're going to have to find some way to get people to grow your food for you, you know. And then also there's a new program that offers resources to support mental health across rural America. And so this is out of New York. Mayville, New York. Rural Minds is a 501c3 not-for-profit with a mission to serve as the informed voice for mental health in rural America and to provide mental health information and resources. Today announced the launch of a comprehensive online resource center to provide actionable mental health information. The material is designed to address the unique challenges faced by rural Americans and offer information that can be used by anyone at no charge to help address the growing mental health crisis in rural communities. The Rural Mental Health Resilience Program is a partnership with the National Grange, one of America's oldest nonpartisan fraternal organizations, established in 1867 to advocate for rural America and agriculture. The program is being launched today by National Rural Health Day at 2 industry events, blah, blah, blah. You can go find all of that at ruralminds.com/resilience or ruralminds.org, rather, /resilience. Sounds like a... I'll click on their website here. And I don't know. There's they got mental health crisis resources, mental health resources. Rural health includes mental health. Rural mental health webinars. Rural mental health news. So I don't know. Might be something to look into. It's got a suicide hotline on top. Dial 988-988. It's a lot of people that struggle with that. So if that's you, maybe something to look into. Give somebody a holler. Don't take it in your own hands like that. That's never a good solution. So, anyways, that's all I got for you. Hope you all have a good week. Get ready for the holidays. And yeah, this has been the Friggin' Farm and Ranch Report for Monday, December 4th. 2023. Now, move your ass. We're burning daylight.
You rise up in the morning beneath the stars so bright. Pull your hat down, make sure your cinch is tight.
moving sun were burning daylight. In the saddle till the job's done right.